Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day.
You ready for the big show?
Right.
Exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
You're a lying dog-faced pony soldier.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest, covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho.
There was nothing I saw at night that would be able to take Donald Trump out.
Honestly, provocative talk.
That is the normalization of lawlessness.
Your voice is beautiful. I've heard it for a long time.
On FM News 101 KXL.
I shredded his state of his mind address.
And now, here's your host.
The credulous boomer rube demo that backs Donald Trump.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and happy Wednesday from the Radio Northwest Network. We supply the Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And by the way, taking the show on the road, tomorrow I'll be live with our Bellingham affiliate, KGMI in Bellingham, and then a public event that evening. I guess they want me to talk about the Second Amendment, the First Amendment, several of the other amendments, maybe what's going on in Washington, D.C., including this gigantic made-up scandal about Roger Stone. Now, you've heard Roger Stone. Perhaps you've heard Roger Stone on this program, an associate of Donald Trump. And like any other associate of Donald Trump, the mainstream media and anybody who has the ability to do it does everything they can to go after anybody connected to Donald Trump. They have, for the last 3 years, tried to make this president, who has done so much for America, so toxic that nobody can afford to work for him. I mean, the paychecks on Capitol Hill and in the White House are actually not that big compared to what these people could make in the private sector. But they've tried to make sure that nobody goes to work for him, that you understand that if you take a job working for a great president, that you'll end up in jail, you'll end up prosecuted, you'll end up broke. You'll end up spending all your money on lawyers. And now they want to take a nearly 70-year-old man and throw him in prison for 10 years. Yeah, he lied to Congress. That's what he was found guilty of. He insists he is not guilty of that. This is part of the aftermath, the collateral damage of the so-called Mueller investigation. And remember what the Mueller investigation was? If you listen to Democrats at the beginning, it was going to be the proof positive that Donald Trump was a Russian mole living in the White House. And at the end of the investigation, it wasn't anything like that. Yes, they found some crazy Russians working for the Russian government trying to mess up our elections. But they also found no connection to Donald Trump. But they did decide to lay waste to anybody around the president. And I could point out to you about a couple of dozen different instances of previous presidents and people who've been prosecuted and presidents who've offered pardons. And yes, I think the president ought to offer a pardon to Roger Stone. But somehow they find it outrageous that the president on Twitter made some comments about the outrageous recommendation that Roger Stone be sent to federal prison for 9 years. He thought that was excessive. You know what's funny? The Department of Justice, which is part of the executive branch and works on behalf of the president, they came to the same conclusion. In fact, if anybody wants to say, well, Donald Trump shouldn't have his attorney general and his Department of Justice who answer to him, they shouldn't listen to the boss at all. You want to advance that theory? I'd be glad to take the naysayer call. You know that we're open to naysayer calls. You go to the head of the line, of course, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coronavirus, we've been updating that. 45,000 now infected, the official number. The actual number may be much higher than that, but it's mostly in China. 25 other countries have some cases, including 13 cases in the United States. And yes, there have been some screw-ups. And yesterday I told you how the World Health Organization, an arm of the UN, which is about as worthless as any government agency you could ever imagine, they came up with a politically correct name for coronavirus, COVID-19, because it officially started in 2019, they said, we can't have a name for a virus that refers to a people or a place or a thing. It has to be just a scientific sounding name. Isn't that goofy? There are lots and lots of disease names in the world already that are named after regions, after people, after towns, after counties, after cities. There's a disease named after a baseball player, for goodness sake. Come on. But they had to be politically correct. But you see, WHO went beyond that. They said, we can't stop the political correctness there. They're criticizing Donald Trump because the United States government stepped up very quickly and said, first of all, we don't want anybody coming into the country from the Hubei province, which is where Wuhan, the Chinese city where most of the cases are centered, don't come into our country. And even the Chinese government restricted travel by people from Wuhan and Hubei. And the U.S. government said, if you come in from that region, you're going to be quarantined for 14 days. Now, does that sound sensible? It does. But the World Health Organization, sitting at a safe distance from the coronavirus, the head of that organization said, well, the United States is trying to restrict travel, and that's just not fair. You know what? When it comes to political correctness, I care more about saving lives than I do political correctness. Just my point of view. Now, let me tell you what our Twitter poll is today. Should the leaders of Northwest sanctuary cities face criminal charges for aiding illegal aliens? Do you know who's suggesting that now? Because I've been suggesting it for a long, long time. In fact, a few years ago, the last time the mayor of Portland was willing to come on this show, the mayor of Seattle never has come on the show, but the last time the mayor of Portland, Ted Wheeler, Stanford educated, very smart guy, supposedly, the last time he was on the show, he said, Lars, do you know that there are people suggesting that I ought to be prosecuted for aiding and abetting illegal aliens? And I looked right at him, sitting 6 feet away from me, and I said, yes, Mr. Mayor, I think you ought to be criminally prosecuted for that. Well, strangely enough, the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, told the National Sheriff's Association, we will consider taking action against any jurisdiction that or any politician who unlawfully obstructs the federal government enforcement of immigration laws. I think that's a bit of a shot across the bow. You may know that the DOJ, as I told you earlier this week, has already brought a lawsuit against King County because King County has tried to has successfully blocked ICE from using Boeing Field to fly people ordered deported out of the country. Now, it doesn't seem unreasonable to deport people from the country when the laws require deportation. But of course, Dow Constantine sticks with the sanctuary city line. As far as I'm concerned, if the DOJ decided to bring criminal charges against Jenny Durkin, mayor of Seattle, Ted Wheeler, mayor of Portland, Dow Constantine, executive of King County, and a whole bunch of others, including Sheriff Mike Reese of Multnomah County, I think they should be tried. I think they should be charged. I think they are aiding and abetting illegal aliens. So in the Twitter poll today, I'm asking you, should the leaders of Northwest sanctuary cities face criminal charges for aiding illegal aliens? I would answer that one yes. Now, yesterday, I asked you about a whole different topic. Should cities and counties even all own golf courses? And I would say no to that. And you should know, I don't golf, but I have nothing against it. I've actually golfed 4 times in my life. Friends persuaded me. They said, we'll show you how to do it. You know how that works out. I did that with skiing as well. Exactly. But I have nothing against golf. In fact, I think it looks like a great game. I just simply don't have the time for it. But I question whether any government agency, city, county, state, whatever, should own a golf course. And here's why. There are plenty of private sector golf courses out there. And I've actually had people say, well, but, you know, the public ones are cheaper. They do tend to be a bit cheaper. But the minute you bring that subject up and say, well, all the cheap golf opportunities for regular citizens will go away if you get rid of the public courses, I immediately got a raft of emails, God bless you, from those of you who do golf and who do know the inexpensive places to do it, who said, oh, no, there are all these public courses not owned by governments that are cheaper than even the government courses. And when the government courses in the Portland area have had to be subsidized by the taxpayers to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars, let's either sell them off to private operators or sell the land and do something more productive with it. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Tomorrow in Bellingham with KGMI, the Northwest Nonsense coming up. I got a few thoughts about what happened in New Hampshire yesterday and the presidential primary. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
Makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
American Democrat Party members have become the masters of their own disaster. The latest proof comes from the Granite State of New Hampshire in yesterday's primary. The presumptive Democrat presidential nominee, Joe Biden, ran from the state last night before the numbers were even counted, with his tail between his legs, before the count showed his percentage at 8%. Now, how did that happen? Well, let me take you back a bit. Barack Obama let blue-collar Joe turn the vice presidency into the family ATM for 8 years. It benefited the Biden clan to the tune of millions of dollars, just as Barack Obama did with Hillary Clinton. She did the same thing on a grander scale. And then, last fall, Nancy Pelosi launched a doomed-to-fail impeachment, and she probably knew it at the time she launched it, against President Trump. But that impeachment effort was guaranteed to shine a spotlight, I'd even say a Kleeg-lite, on Biden's corrupt activities in Ukraine, and that doomed his campaign. That leaves the Democrats with the communist from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, who won last night and has a tremendous chance to win the nomination this summer, at least on paper. The party knows that Bernie's $100 trillion plans for the Green New Deal, Medicare for all, and paying off your student debts can't possibly win in November. So I'll bet they plan to cheat Bernie out of the nomination again. And that is likely to splinter the party of slavery and the Klan with angry voters, who then the Democrats will hope to show up and vote ABT, anybody but Trump. The die is cast in the corruption of this political party, and America will enjoy, thankfully, 4 more years of the president who made America great again. I can't wait for it. From Facebook, Jim Miguel writes in, Lars, so now, Lars, Biden retreats to South Carolina to get those black votes that he is entitled to from all the good things the Democrats have done for black Americans. Methinks the black Americans are on to the Democrats for keeping them in their place, and that they will always think the Democrats are their savior. But maybe they finally woke up and realized there is somebody out there that has actually done something for them. Signed, Jim Miguel. Jim, I think you're right. The polls show that Donald Trump is likely to take a record number of American black voters in the fall of this year. And I think it's going to stun the Democrats. They have, for a long time, acted as though they owned the black vote, and they do not. They finally have a president who's done real things for them. Real jobs, real wage increases, real opportunities for your kids. It's kind of hard to ignore that. From Twitter, Jason Schaefer writes, and Lars, listening to you and John Carlson on KVI yesterday and this morning about presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, I didn't go to college. I'm also a high school dropout with my GED. The last 14 years, I've been in a trade. I'm a sprinkler fitter. Not once has anybody, let alone the government, offered to pay for my tools, my gas, my license to do my work. Why should we give kids for going to college by choice, not required to go, and spending money they do not have? Schools need to do a better job of teaching kids that they need to pick a career that will pay for their student loans or work through college and pay for it themselves. Keep up good work, and thank you, Jason Schaefer. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, today's Daily Grill goes to the Metro Regional Government, one of the most useless government agencies in existence, for violating the state public meetings law, the law that requires that public meetings be held and minimum notice provided to the public. Now, I'll give the full credit to the Cascade Policy Institute, which identified two important meetings of what's called the Parks and Nature Oversight Committee. And you might think, why do I care about the Parks and Nature Oversight Committee? Well, I'll tell you why. This committee is the one pushing forward a $1.5 billion tax measure for a vote. Now, fact is, state law says that if public bodies, that includes the Metro Council, it includes city councils, it includes county commission meetings, it includes the legislature. And in Washington State, they have a similar public meetings law because they found that folks in government like to do things in, back then, smoke-filled dark back rooms outside of the sight of the public. So the law says you have to do it in public, and you have to notify the public. You can't say, oh, you didn't hear about that meeting? Sorry about that. Maybe you'll make the next one. In these two meetings, Councillor Sam Chase informed the rest of the Metro Council he had met with the Oversight Committee earlier in the day. At the meeting, he and the committee talked about issues. Well, Dr. Eric Fruits from Cascade Policy raised the question of the Parks and Nature Program. Councillor Chase said he and the committee talked about the administrative costs of the Parks and Nature Program, which skyrocketed last year. Kind of a nice thing to have out of public sight, right? There was another meeting last September. There is no record of a public notice announcing the meeting. According to the minutes of the meeting, the committee discussed the program's administrative costs, which at the time were running at 20%. Or double the amount that Metro had promised to voters. So a government agency makes a promise. It involves millions of dollars, and then the promise is not kept. Should the public know about that? Other issues included the upcoming Parks and Nature ballot measure. They might as well call it Motherhood and Apple Pie. They put all these sweet names on it. Let me tell you what it really is. A massive $500 million tax grab by the most useless government agency in the Northwest, and they're not telling the public about their meetings. Now, today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Oregon Mint Snuff. I love the stuff. Put some mint in your mouth. Eric writes, and Lars, I hope all is well with you. As a native of Seattle and a resident of Portland going on 5 years, I'm done. Since 2016, I have not been able to walk downtown for fear of being assaulted or jumped. This has happened 3 times to me. I've watched my pay go up about 25%, but by moving tax brackets, I take home 5% more than the wage I started at. Housing prices have hyperinflated by Silicon Valley liberals. I can't even buy a condo for under $150. I watch the Portland police constantly ignore the plight of people, and I can no longer accept they're just taking orders. They don't care. I have always supported the police, and I still do. But the PPB, I consider them communist soldiers at this point. To hear them say, we won't help you or protect you, I played you the audio of that yesterday. Every time Antifa assembles and watch them continue to be derelict, I'm sorry, but orders or not, if somebody's being attacked left or right, they should bring down the righteous hammer of fury on them. I'm done. It's the final straw. I'm a good, God-fearing, hard-working man. I don't commit crime. I treat everybody, even those I dislike, with respect and courtesy, and I give more to my community than I take. It's people like me that are leaving, and what will that leave Portland with? Many of us who keep Portland livable are leaving come October. I'm headed to Phoenix. While it's a purple state, at least has the common sense to maintain law and order. Signed, Eric. Now, I want to tell you one development that has literally happened just in the last few minutes. A judge has now rejected, most of these are double negatives, a judge has rejected most of the challenge to Tim Iman's $30 car tab measure. Let me remind you. A ballot measure that asked voters in Washington state, do you want to have car tabs set back to $30 instead of the stratospheric prices that were being asked by government to raise money? Iman's measure passed, so the voters had their say and said, you will bring those costs down to $30. There was a court challenge to it. The judge has now rejected the court challenge. Tim Iman's $30 car tab is upheld, and I look forward to talking to Tim Iman, I hope, later on today. Glad to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. I'll be in Bellingham yesterday or tomorrow with KGMI, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network. Our Twitter poll question today, should the leaders of Northwest sanctuary cities face criminal charges for aiding illegals, as the current United States Attorney General William Barr is suggesting? Today's Twitter poll found at Lars Larson Show on Twitter, LarsLarson.com on our fine website, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for your business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I would be lying to you if I didn't admit to you that there have been times in my life where I've lived beyond my means. And sometimes I did it because I took a lower paying job to advance my career, and you live on a credit card for a while. But if the bet pays off well, then you do better. And if the bet doesn't pay off well, then lesson learned. But when public officials live beyond their means and then begin to dip into pots of cash that really shouldn't be spent on their personal living expenses, I think it's right to raise questions. And of course, those questions are being raised, of course, by the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Nigel Drakewitz from Willamette Week. You can find his stories at WWeek.com. Nigel, welcome back to the program. And this one concerns somebody who, in all likelihood, might have been on track to someday become the governor of Oregon. It's a blue state, and her politics, Julie Williamson's politics, are not my politics, but she was on that kind of track, and that's been so badly derailed, she pulled herself out of a major race for Secretary of State that she was the odds-on favorite to win. Am I missing anything there?
No, I think you got it right, except her first name, Jennifer.
Jennifer Williamson, correction.
I think it's fair to say that Williamson, who was the former House Majority Leader, the number two ranking officer in the House, was likely to win the Secretary of State's race. That would put her in a pretty good position to become governor at some point. And on Monday, my colleague Rachel Monahan and I had prepared a story. Williamson knew what was in the story. And on Monday, she abruptly resigned from the race, pulled out of the race before we actually published the story, which is very rare in my experience. And the story was about what you alluded to. She was using her campaign funds for a variety of unusual purposes, a lot of foreign travel, exotic travel within the U.S. She was paying for an apartment and a campaign office, renting both from family members. And when legislators are in session in Salem, they get $151 a day for living expenses to cover their rent and to cover their meals. During the time the legislature was in session, she was also spending lavishly on meals and paying her rent from her campaign funds.
Now, when you say lavishly, for example, last year, your story at WWeek.com documents that in a six-month period, she spent about, $10,000 or maybe $1,500 a month on meals and drinks, which is pretty good spending on meals and drinks, isn't it?
Right. Now, bear in mind that during those 6 months, for most of that period, she was getting $151 a day in addition to her legislative salary, which is modest. But she also draws a second salary because she was the head of the Democratic House caucus. So she's getting two salaries plus $151 a day. That's enough to live on in Salem, where, you know, restaurants and apartments are pretty reasonably priced. But yes, she then spent an additional $10,000 from her campaign account on restaurants and meals and drinks and so on.
Now, Nigel, I want to ask you something, because this is odd for somebody to do a story. I've done stories that have caused changes in public agencies and such. But as you say, it usually doesn't happen where somebody resigns before or decides to pull out of a race. She hasn't resigned from anything, but she's pulled out of the race that she was the odds-on favorite to win. But is any of what she did with that campaign cash overtly illegal?
No, I don't think so, and we're not arguing that it is.
Agreed.
Oregon has, as you
know... I just
want
to bring that up so people know that we're not saying she did anything illegal, but it's so questionable, it doesn't have to be illegal, right?
No, I think there are two important points to make here. One is that the Secretary of State is the state's elections, chief elections officer, and therefore in charge of making sure elections happen properly, but also kind of keeping an eye on how people use campaign funds. So that's one. And number two, you alluded to her living beyond her means, which I believe is certainly the case at the outset. But the other thing that's very important that the Secretary of State does is the Secretary of State is in charge of the audit function, so in charge of making sure that all state agencies are spending money appropriately. And, of course, you'd have to ask, if you can't manage your own finances responsibly, why would we put you in charge of making sure the state is managing its finances responsibly? So there's absolutely, we are not saying she broke the law. I don't believe she did. But I do believe that she did things that probably disqualified her from holding the office that she was likely to win.
Okay, and the other thing that you emphasize in the story, but I want to put a special emphasis on it, lest anybody think of Jennifer Williamson as this, you know, perhaps a hardworking public servant who goes home to a modest home and lives, you know, very, you know, and is eating tuna casserole. She lives in a $1.4 million house, and she is in arrears to the State Department of the Department of Revenue for more than $10,000 in back taxes that have been on the books for 4 years. So I guess I'd suggest, if you can't pay your taxes on time, but you vote on tax increases on the rest of us, and you live in a $1.4 million home. I don't live in a $1.4 million home, and I earn all of my money. I don't get any of it from a government agency. It does suggest you're living beyond your means, because apparently you have the money for a very expensive, well above average home, and you don't have the money to pay the taxes that you've owed for years. But so you're dipping into your campaign cash to do what, and some of these trips sound like they were just fun trips. I mean, they may have had some justification, like she was giving a speech or going to a conference, but she was traveling all over the world, right?
Yeah, it's unusual. I mean, we'll see legislators who, you know, they'll go to a state conference or a national conference, but she was in Ireland, she was in Hong Kong, she was in China, she was in Germany, you know, she was in Hawaii, she was in Denver, Boston, Los Angeles, Atlanta, New Orleans. I could keep going. She was traveling extensively and staying at extremely nice hotels and eating at very nice restaurants. And, you know, she was in legislative leadership. We might see a legislative leader take one or two trips a year. We compare to her to Jenny Burdick, who is the opposite in the Senate. She is the Senate Majority Leader, and I think Williamson's travel, her plane fare, she spent five times what Burdick spent on plane fare over the same eight-year period, and I think three or four times what Burdick spent on hotels and resorts. So her use of her campaign funds was just completely out of the ordinary.
Well, the other thing I wanted to ask, and that's this, how much of this travel even had some sort of tangential connection to her legislative duties or to running for office, like going to Ireland? Did that somehow relate to her ability to run for Secretary of State and would justify spending campaign cash?
She initially told my colleague Rachel Monahan that all the trips were justified, that she was on boards or commissions or had other official connections.
In Ireland?
She then backed away from that a little bit, and then she stopped answering our questions. So it's a little bit unclear.
So you'd probably guess she won't be willing to come on my show and maybe answer some of those questions, like what was going on in Ireland that might somehow relate to being Secretary of State or being in the Oregon legislature?
I think it's unlikely, Lars, but you never know.
Well, I'll tell you, hope springs eternal. And I'll tell you what, I highly recommend the reporting of the Pulitzer Prize winner Nigel Jaques. Oh, one last question. Was there something else? I mean, I know you did a four-week investigation on her. Is there something else? And the reason she quit so quickly, is there some other dirt in there that she thought, if I keep the race going, they're going to find this too that didn't come out in your story? Is there any suggestion of other things?
I just can't answer that question, not because I'm hiding anything from you. We're still reporting.
Okay. Well, that at least that promises perhaps more to come. And the fact that she's dropped out is not going to cool your ardor for pursuing this one, right?
Absolutely.
That is the Pulitzer Prize winner, Nigel Jaques. You can find the story at WWeek.com. What would make you quit a run you're virtually certain to win and one that could lead to the governor's office? And all of a sudden you jump out before the story even pops and say, hey, I'm going to get out of here. I'm dropping the race altogether, and probably that means the governor's race at some point in the future. When we come back, the government claims it wants more housing, but it turns out I've got a great example of where the government is the biggest barrier to more housing, and it's from one of you, a loyal Lars listener. You got the Lars Larson Show.
It's government gone wild.
Oh, hell no.
Now exposed every day on the Lars Larson Show.
Well, this is a good example because you're constantly hearing government leaders in Oregon and Washington and Idaho complaining, we need more housing. Why can't we get more housing? I guess the government will just have to build more housing. No, you don't. Tell the government to get out of the way. I think the government is the biggest barrier. And I got this email today from Scott, and he provides a great example. And you tell me if this does not prove the point that government is the biggest barrier to getting more affordable housing. He says, Lars, I was going to split my quarter-acre lot and put a bigger house on the other lot and then rent out the old house to a family for as cheap as I could. $60,000 to $70,000 for city and state permits would have meant that I would have had to charge $1,650 to $1,800 a month just to cover the cost of the permits. So much for affordable housing. Why would I do that? If now I have to let people live there for 6 months without paying rent, that's the Seattle measure that was passed earlier this week. So this would not apply to other things outside of Seattle. But he says that could get my property foreclosed on. I've already done that. I would sell my rental to avoid risking foreclosure. Many others will do the same. But his point that the government says, oh, you want to build some housing and you'd like to make it affordable. Well, we'd like to add $60,000 to $70,000 to the cost before you even turn over a shovel full of dirt and before you sink a single nail into a single board. Now, let me go to a naysayer, because we love naysayers on this program. I began the hour by mentioning Roger Stone and that I think that Roger Stone should not go to prison for 9 years. That opinion is shared by the President of the United States and by the Department of Justice, and I think right-thinking people anywhere. James is a naysayer to that. James, is that what we disagree about today?
Well, Lars, I want to make this clear. Are you saying that he shouldn't go to prison at all?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that 9 years is ridiculous.
You said that Trump should pardon him.
Well, I do think that President should pardon him because I don't think Stone did anything wrong.
Well, I think that the jury found him guilty of witness tampering, obstruction of justice, and making false statements.
In the Mueller investigation, which turned out to be an investigation of nothing. Do you remember what the original cause of the Mueller investigation was? We think Donald Trump is a Russian.
I think we're talking about Roger Stone and not the original Mueller investigation. We're talking about Roger Stone being convicted by a federal jury of witness tampering, obstruction, making false statements.
Related
now,
to
know
the
you're,
Mueller investigation.
I know you're a conservative.
Related
you're
to the Mueller investigation.
You're unapologetic support of Trump. You're
not unapologetic. There are things
Trump.
I disagree with the president about, but let me point something out. Do you remember Roger Clinton, the president's brother? I'm going to compare to other pardons.
Roger Stone is guilty.
Okay, do you want to say that five more times just to get it out of your system? And then I'm going to provide you an example.
I'll say this, that he and Trump were buddies.
You won't, because you're not going to just roll. You know what, James, I won't let you steamroller me. Now, you don't want Roger Stone pardoned. I will point out, Roger Clinton, the president's brother, was convicted on drug charges. He was pardoned. Susan McDougal, who refused to testify about Clinton's role in Whitewater, was pardoned. Mark Rich, who is a tax cheat involved in racketeering and illegal trading with Iran, was pardoned. Former Democratic Congressman Dan Rostenkowski was pardoned for his role in the congressional post office scandal. All those people got pardons. Tell me why Roger Stone does not deserve a pardon in this case. James?
I think that Roger Stone is a dirty trickster, has been all his life. He met Trump early in the 70s.
We're not going to go back into the history of the world now, James. Don't fill the air with words. Tell me why he shouldn't be pardoned.
He shouldn't be pardoned because he's guilty.
So was Mark Rich. So was Roger Clinton. So was Susan McDougal. All of those people were found guilty, and they were all pardoned. And the Democrats and the media didn't seem to see a problem with it. But all of a sudden, if it's Donald Trump, anything he does is wrong. Not such a good naysayer, but okay. James, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Aaron. Hey, Aaron, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, I'm a long-time listener, Lars. I really appreciate what you do.
Thank you.
And I'm ex-Marine Corps.
Thank you for that.
I got to go to the VA three times a week. Got to come through Portland. I live in downtown Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered, you know, sometimes I got to go through there and they got protests. And I'm tired of getting caught up in the Antifa thing. And I got a question for you, and then I'll hang up.
Well, no, you won't hang up. I want to talk to you. What's the question? Let's get to that because you're going to run out of daylight real soon.
Yeah, I know. A federal charge with Antifa, with these assaults that they've been committing, why can't they get them on civil rights violations, Lars?
Well, here's the problem. If you want the answer to that directly, what civil right are they violating? So if you beat up somebody who's black because they're black, you can make a civil rights case. Same thing for gay, same thing for female, same thing for a lot of protected categories. if Antifa beats up an ordinary law-abiding citizen who happens to be conservative and out taking pictures, what civil right are they interfering with? It's more common. It would be more likely to be a criminal prosecution for assault on the local level. But as a federal civil rights case, I think it's kind of weak.
I guess you just seen in the Democratic political climate that they got that, you know, if you look at somebody cross-eyed that, you know, carries a rainbow flag around, or, and then it's perfectly okay for them to violate somebody else's civil rights or call them a racist or what have you. Yeah. I just don't get why they blatantly get away with coming right out and destroying property, assaulting people.
I couldn't agree with you more, but being a conservative, fortunately, does not put us in a protected class. I don't like protected classes. I don't want there to be protected classes. I'd like to see all Americans be equal under the law. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
You're a lying dog-faced pony soldier.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest, covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho.
There was nothing I saw at night that would be able to take Donald Trump out.
Honestly, provocative talk.
That is the normalization of lawlessness.
Your voice is beautiful. I've heard it for a long time.
On FM News 101 KXL.
I shred at his state of his mind address.
And now, here's your host.
The credulous boomer rube demo that backs Donald Trump.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. Glad to be with you and glad to take your calls too at 866-HEY-LARS. You know, we got a lot of things to talk about. And a little show note, tomorrow I'll be in Bellingham, Washington with our affiliate KGMI, and I'm doing a public event that evening and then back in the studio for First Amendment Friday. Glad you could join me today from all over the Radio Northwest Territory, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And if you want to jump in to the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Now, I always disclose my dog in the fight. I drive to work, so I care about whether or not governments, either in Oregon or Washington, start to slap tolls on freeways that I have helped pay for, along with all of you who consume, you know, whose vehicles consume diesel and gasoline. So I'm against those tolls. It's like renting back something that you already paid for, and I think it's outrageous. And that's one issue. The second issue, and I have a position on that as well, the carbon tax bill, they're calling it all kinds of other fancy names to confuse you. But if they were really honest at the legislature, the Democrats would say, we want a $700 million carbon tax that is going to hit everybody, every industry, every person. And if you say, well, I don't drive a car, I don't own a company that consumes gasoline and diesel, doesn't matter. Everything you wear, everything you eat, the house you live in, the heat you enjoy in your bathroom or in your house, the hot water you enjoy in your bathroom, it is all dependent on this. And that $700 million will come out of your pocket. Unless, of course, you're somebody who lives on the street, has no hot water, no roof over your head, no heat, and does not eat food or wear clothing. If you're buck naked and starving, And living in an unheated space, I guess you would be free from the carbon tax bill being pushed by Kate Brown and the carbon Democrats down in Salem. Now, one of the non-carbon Democrats, and nobody is going to call him a dog-faced pony soldier, is Mike Nierman, who's an Oregon state lawmaker and a good friend of the show. Mike, welcome back.
Good. Thanks, Lars. Except I'm not a Democrat. I'm a Republican.
I apologize for that misstatement. I just said you're not a dog-faced pony soldier, and you're not. But I'm just making fun of Joe Biden because he's crazy. And, and he's also losing. So I guess maybe I should leave him alone. Let him suffer in peace. Mike Nierman is an Oregon state lawmaker, and he is a Republican, and he's a good friend of the show. Let's start. We'll get to the carbon tax bill in a second. What is there an effort to actually let the voters have a vote on whether or not tolls are imposed on the freeways they drive on?
Right. And what this is about tolling roads, like you said, that we've already paid for. And the pernicious part of it is that the money raised from those tolls doesn't have to go back into making more roads or maintaining the roads or anything like that. They can spend it on whatever they want. They can spend it on homelessness or green energy or whatever they want. It's not like the gas tax that has to go back into roads. So what we have is we have a ballot initiative that we're trying to put on for the 2020 ballot. And we need to get a boatload of signatures on this, and I was hoping that people could help us out. If you go to our website, it's voteontolls.com, and you can download one of those single-signer petitions there. But what this does is it says that they can't put a toll on any road that we've already paid for unless they get a majority vote in the state and a majority in each county in which the toll is imposed. So it's a pretty high bar to cross there.
That seems like a fair test. If it actually got a majority in every single county it's being imposed in, say Multnomah County, Clackamas County, Washington County, in the case of the Portland Metro tolls, because, you know, Seattle's got the same problem. They keep slapping tolls on everywhere, and they're punishing people, saying unless you're willing to pay an extra $10 a trip in some cases, you can't drive in the fast lane. Drive over in the slow lane with the poor people and let the doctors and lawyers and talk show hosts drive on by. I don't think that's fair at all. Let me ask you about this carbon tax bill. And first of all, sure. do you have any problem with me calling it a carbon tax? And is that more honest than cap and trade or cap and invest or greenhouse gas? It's being called all those things by the mainstream media. And I think it's just dead wrong. It's a tax on carbon, and it doesn't necessarily do anything about gas, right?
Yes, you're exactly right. It is a tax, and the government is making up the original carbon credits, and the government will sell those. And so it's not that they say, oh, this is using a free market mechanism. No, it's not. The government's creating these carbon credits out of whole cloth and then sells people the right to pollute. So that is a tax there. So, I think you're right to call it a tax, yeah.
All right, is this thing going to pass? Because at this point, is there any reason it's a short session? You have only a few more weeks. And if things are allowed to go the way they're going, this thing is going to pass and get signed by Kate Brown, isn't it?
Yep, it's got the votes to pass, I believe. In the last session, I think in the Senate, they shut it down. They had a couple of Democrats who were a little wobbly on it, and I think they have the votes to pass it this time. So I don't think it's going to pass, though. I think some of us are going to conveniently go on vacation about the time that bill comes up for a hearing. So
head off to Washington or Idaho or some undisclosed location. Look, I'm talking to Republican state lawmaker Mike Nierman, who's with me. You're going to have to walk out to make this thing stop, aren't you?
I believe so, yeah. I believe that's our only option left.
So why are they not listening to reason? I mean, maybe it's too much to ask for Kate Brown and the Democrats to listen to reason, but they want to do this to people, and I don't even think they're being honest, because is any of the money guaranteed to go to anything that actually reduces greenhouse gas? Even if you buy the theory that Oregon's going to save the planet by reducing its greenhouse gases, which I think are 0.2% of the world's greenhouse gases, is there anything in this that guarantees a single dime from that tax will go to greenhouse gas reduction?
Well, you know, as you know, any future legislature can undo whatever the current legislature's done. So even if there are dedicated uses for the revenue raised, that any future legislature can come along and repurpose those. So no, there's no guarantee that this will be used for any kind of cleaner environment or anything like that. And I'm with you on this. I like clean air and I like clean water. That's one of the reasons I like living in Oregon. And we actually, if you count all the trees and everything that we have in Oregon, we're a net carbon eater on the planet. So, I don't think that there's anything that this bill is going to do to make the planet any better. So,
well, you actually made that case on this show, and I credit you for it. If you add up all the carbon dioxide or carbon production activities of human beings, and then you add up all the carbon consumption of forests within the state of Oregon, we're net carbon neutral, or we're actually negative carbon right now,
right.
Correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so because we're negative carbon, I guess we need to punish ourselves and be whatever, even harder on carbon. So we're talking about shutting down one coal-fired plant in eastern Oregon. And maybe we need to do that. That's on the table, whatever. We could talk about that. But while we're going to shut down that one plant, China is going to build 100 more. And so we're not gaining anything by punishing ourselves. And so it's just, it kind of doesn't make sense in that sense there.
Well, not only that, but Mike, I hope people are paying attention. We on the show over the last several weeks or several months, we've been talking about the fact that the Northwest Power Planning Authorities, government agencies, have said we are now dramatically increasing the likelihood of blackouts in the region, and that they head to a 30% chance of blackouts from less than 2% right now by 2030. So within 10 years, we could be sitting in the dark just like the folks in California. Mike, keep up the fight in the legislature. That's Mike Nierman, Republican state lawmaker from Salem. When we come back, legislative tricks are being used to stop government transparency, and we'll get your phone calls and emails at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com.
You're listening to the Lars Larson Show on FM News 101.
Welcome back.
With each new day in this crazy and somewhat disturbing country of ours comes that one story, the headline that, when you hear it, only one response comes to mind.
Are you kidding?
You gotta be kidding me.
You gotta be kidding me.
You must be joking.
No, really, it's true.
Now, here's Lars with today's Are You Kidding Me moment.
Are you kidding me?
This Are You Kidding Me moment has to do with some more tricks from the legislature and from Governor Kate Brown. I have to remind you about a little bit of history. You see, the Democrats always talk a good game about being transparent. Transparent is the fancy word for government actually letting the citizens know what is going on inside of government. After all, we are the stockholders. We are the voters. We should know what's going on inside the government. So they created a position, public records advocate. And there was a young lady in that position by the name of Ginger McCall last year. Well, she resigned from the job, and she didn't just quit. She wrote a very pointed letter saying that the governor, Governor Kate Brown's staff, had come to her and said, look, your job is not first to look out for whether or not the citizens know what's going on. Your job is not public transparency. Your job is to protect Governor Kate Brown. And she wrote a letter saying, look, I'm not going to do this job if you think that I'm supposed to call myself the public records advocate, that is making sure that citizens have access to public records, if my real job is just to run political interference for Kate Brown. So she quit. Now we have Senate Bill 1506. And what that would do is take control of the public records advocate away from the governor's office and assign it to a 13-member public records council. Now, what's the cost of that? Essentially zero. You have the same person hired to be the public records advocate. It's just a different body naming the public records advocate. And she answers, or he answers, whoever it happens to be, to that 13-member council instead of answering to the governor and doing Governor Kate Brown's bidding, or whoever happens to be the governor. Well, here's what they did with the bill. Peter Courtney, Democrat of Salem, Senate president, said, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to tag the bill. A long time ago, they said, if a bill comes in and it has some kind of economic impact on the state budget, if it's going to cost money, then we have to do an analysis, what they call a fiscal impact, saying if you're proposing that we do something in a new law and it's going to cost money, we have to figure out how much money is it going to cost, and then the legislature will vote on that. Well, this is a short legislative session. They could pass this thing in a heartbeat, but they have decided not to. But they don't want to just vote it down, because that would look bad if you were voting against public transparency and public records advocacy. So what Peter Courtney, who's a sneaky, he is a lying dog-faced pony soldier, as far as I'm concerned, he has tagged it as having a potential light impact on the state budget. There's no indication this is going to cost any money at all. They're simply taking the same position and saying, instead of being hired by the governor, you're going to be hired by this public records council. And instead of answering to the governor and being the governor's political tool, you're going to answer to this 13-member public records council, which will be at least somewhat more accountable to the public. Peter Courtney knows that by tagging the bill saying, oh, this might cost us 10 cents, that he's forcing it to go through a fiscal impact. And what that means is it will delay it. and it'll delay it long enough that the legislative session, this is designed to be a short one, is simply not able to pass it. It'll get pushed off till next year. This is the kind of sneaky baloney that citizens don't like. And I think this is bipartisan. I would guess that there are Democrats who want public transparency, and there are Republicans who want public transparency. And now, Peter Courtney and Kate Brown and the usual cabal down in Salem have decided we don't really want transparency, but we don't want to be seen to be voting against transparency, so we're finding a different way to defeat this. That is, oh, wow, are you kidding? Let's go to Gary. Hey, Gary, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call, Lars. Last year, now you mentioned something about legislators having to leave the city. Last year, Kate Brown and Peter Courtney conspired to send the state police out to round up senators who were left to deny
which they're allowed to do.
Well, but they can't, on what they legal can't, theory or what constitutional
the legislature has the right that if you're a state lawmaker and you've decided you're going to sit down at the local bar in Salem and drink whiskey instead of going and attending the legislature, they have the authority to send the state police to go corral you. So what the lawmakers had to do to deny a quorum, that is to prevent a vote from happening on this carbon tax that they want to vote on and jack $700 million out of the pockets of citizens and destroy whole industries like logging and farming and food production, the only way to do it is if you leave the state. So if you have Republicans who simply leave the state, they go to Idaho, they go to Washington, they could go to California, although God knows why, and that if you do that, then the state police can't go round you up, and the legislature is denied a quorum. If you've ever been on any kind of public body that operates under what's called Robert's Rules of Order, it's the way that parliamentary bodies operate. And it's usual meeting rules for virtually every city council, county commission, et cetera, in America at least, and maybe in many parts of the world. You say, if you're going to have a vote on something, you have to have a quorum. So let's say you have a 7-member city council, and 2 members show up and say, we're in favor of this, and there's nobody else here. We'll just have a vote, and we'll vote on it. The other 5 members won't be involved. The quorum rule would come in and say, nope. You're going to have a majority of the members there. So out of the 7, 4 of them would have to be there for a vote to be had. Otherwise, every legislative body could simply get 2 lawmakers in the same room and they could vote on anything while all the other lawmakers are asleep or whatever. So the quorum rule says you have to have a minimum number there to take a vote. By leaving the state.
I have another question.
Go ahead. Does that answer your question?
All right. Yeah, it does. But what level of force does OSP have in order to compel them to come back?
They have the legal authority to go out and apprehend state lawmakers and drag them back to the Capitol by force.
By force?
Yeah. If a state police officer walks up to you and says, I have the legal authority to bring you back to the Capitol, and you decide to fight him, then you're resisting arrest. I mean, they have the legal authority. So, Gary, that's as simple as I can tell you. They have the legal authority. The sergeant at arms.
You've answered the question. You've answered it, and that's what I wanted to know. And I thank you for taking the time to do that.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very much. Let's go to Gordon in Seattle. Gordon, what's on your mind today? You want to talk about coronavirus, which has now killed more than 1,000 people worldwide?
Well, I got some information today. There is a organization called Tencent, T-E-N-C-E-N-T, and it keeps track of every computer game in the world, and it's actually in China.
It's the world's largest video game company. And,
right.
And?
Well, China apparently sent something to them that told the truth about the coronavirus in China. And I sent you a copy of it.
I've seen it. I'm going to tell you that I think the numbers coming out of China are phony, but I don't know that something from the internet that's labeled as coming from Tencent that then came to them from someone else inside the Chinese government. I'm not sure I would trust that set of numbers any more than the official numbers that China has been shoveling out to us. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network and always glad to get your calls. We have a Twitter poll, as we do every day. The question today, should Northwest leaders of sanctuary cities face criminal charges for aiding illegal aliens? I would answer that one yes. And why do we ask that question? I've been proposing for years that the federal government come in and say, if you're going to effectively aid and abet illegal aliens, then you're going to face criminal charges for aiding and abetting. Well, now, none other than the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, has said that he is considering it. He told this to the National Sheriff's Association. We will consider taking action against any politician who unlawfully obstructs the federal enforcement of immigration law. Bravo, William Barr. Now, I can make you a short list right now. Sheriff Mike Reese of Multnomah County, the Sheriff of King County, Jenny Durkin of the City of Seattle, the county executive of King County. I'd put him on the list. Jenny, I'd also put on Kate Brown and Jay Inslee. They should all be prosecuted. You can find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show on Twitter or LarsLarson.com on the web, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for your business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the program Dr. Eric Fruits from the Cascade Policy Institute. Dr. Fruits, welcome back to the program.
Hey, great to be on. Good afternoon.
So just a moment ago, I was regaling my audience with the latest craziness in Salem, where they don't want to vote on a transparency bill to move the public records advocate over to a 13-member council, because apparently Peter Courtney and Kate Brown like this person to answer directly to Kate Brown, so Kate Brown's staff can tell her, in the case of Ginger McCall, your job is not public records, your job is protecting the governor. Well, they've tried some tricks down there. You wrote a great piece for the Cascade Policy Institute about a public body that I would be willing to bet if I walked down the street and asked people, do you know what the metro regional government is? I'd probably get a deer in the headlights look more often than not. It is, in my book, one of the most useless government agencies in the world. They love to brag that they're the only directly elected regional government in America. Sometimes when you're the only one doing it, it's because you're so unique. Sometimes it's because you're the only one dumb enough to do it. But this agency wants to ask the voters for about almost, it's just shy of $500 million for what they call nature and parks. And I looked at that and I said, but then you've identified that this government agency has been violating the public records law, public meetings law, that says if you're going to talk about things like this, and if you're going to talk about information about how Metro is failing in its estimates of how much these programs would cost, you have to do it in public and you have to tell the public the meeting is going to happen. What has Metro been doing?
Well, you know, Cascade Policy Institute has been following Metro for years, and we often send people down there to those meetings. And it's really important that we're there, because at those meetings, they say things that they wouldn't say otherwise, because they think no one's listening. And there was a meeting on Tuesday, February 4th, on an oversight committee that's supposed to be making sure they're the watchdogs of this Parks and Nature program. And I had some testimony a few weeks before that, saying that this oversight committee is not really doing their job. So then they had a meeting last Tuesday of that committee with a Metro counselor. That is a public meeting. No one was notified of it. And my suspicion is because they didn't want me to show up to hear what they're going to say about my work and my testimony.
Because they'd say, how are we going to answer this charge that we promised 10% costs on something, the costs have gone to 20% or more, and we don't want to say that in public, and we don't want the public to know we're saying it, because if they did, it might actually shoot a hole in their plan to ask for $475 million to do even more of this parks and nature stuff.
Well, that's right. And then remember, we have another $300 million a year tax measure that might be going on the ballot in May 2020. They really do not want to be under a lot of scrutiny. And these public meetings laws are serious stuff. It's not just a slap on the wrist. If you violate it, you as a member of one of those committees can be personally responsible for court costs and any sort of damages. And so it's a really big deal that the public knows that there's a meeting going on so that they can actually watch their government in action.
Although, Dr. Fruits, if I had my druthers, I'd say if you're found guilty of deliberately violating the public meetings law, maybe you should forfeit your position. Or maybe for a small sanction, you could be suspended from your position on that government body for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. I mean, I could think of a lot tougher things because, unfortunately, I see a lot of public agencies, including schools that go out and do electioneering on the public's dime. And if they get caught, they've done $50,000 worth of electioneering and somebody has to pay a $500 fine. It's the kind of deal that especially Democrats will sign up for all day long. They'll say, well, if we can get $50,000 worth of publicity and only costs us a $500 fine, yeah, go for it.
Yeah, the ROI on that is just fantastic. I think that we need to have more teeth on it. And actually, the violation of the public meetings laws is really hard to enforce. The only way to really enforce it is to go to court and, you know, tell them to buck up. And I think we really need something with more teeth because, again, these public meetings, they are public and they are meetings. This is where they are deciding where to spend your money and how they're going to infringe on your freedoms and your property rights. And you should be there. And if you can't be there, then groups like Cascade Policy Institute should be there because, you know, part of our job is to be watchdogs for the people of Portland.
Well, I can think of a way to fix that, Dr. Fruits. I don't know if it would ever get past the Democrat-controlled legislature in Salem or a similar, because Washington State has public meetings laws as well, and they also get violated. But can you imagine if you had, let's say you had a small committee and said all the cases are going to go to court, but the first step is, say, a body made up of the governor, the Senate president, and, you know, I mean, put a couple of people on it who are of significance and who've been chosen by the voters and say, If you want to go first to that body and say, it appears to me they called a meeting, they had a meeting, they held the meeting, they didn't notify the public, and you make the case, if that body says, oh, no, we don't think it was a violation, then you can go on to court. But then that body is going to look foolish when the court later says, of course there was a violation. It was documented right here. And if those were public meetings and you were able to call people on the carpet very quickly and very inexpensively and very expeditiously, you might actually get more bodies to comply with the law. What do you think of an idea like that?
I think we actually have a framework already in place to do that. They just don't have the right to do it. You know, one is the Government Ethics Commission, and the other one is the Public Records Advocate, which you just talked about. You know, why not make the Public Records Advocate the Public Records and Public Meetings Advocate?
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, it would be fair if you said the Public Records Advocate can look at a case. You walk in and say they held a meeting. Here are the minutes from the meeting. There was no public notice. That's easy to determine whether they sent out either emails or physical mails or ran advertising or whatever. And I think it has to be a minimum of 24 hours notice, does it not?
Right.
And even that is kind of thin. I mean, if I hear at 4 o'clock on a Wednesday that there's going to be a meeting of a body at 4 o'clock on a Thursday, it's a very short time period to be able to respond by saying, okay, I'll drop everything in my life and I'll head down to that public meeting tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. Even that is kind of thin, but that's what the law is. They can't even seem to comply with that law. So if you said the Public Records Advocate can decide that you violated the public records law and then say, maybe you have a system where that advocate can say, go ahead, if you want a show cause hearing where you show up in front of a judge on short notice and say to the judge, the show cause, is there any reason to believe that the public records advocate was wrong in her judgment or his judgment call on this, whichever it happens to be, it was a young lady, then the public records advocate gets called on it if she or she is making the wrong decision, you know, more often than once or twice. And you'd have a way to win if you're the public body saying, we did tell people about the meeting. Nobody came. But I think you're absolutely right. And the fact that they're trying to hide the ball when they're coming up to asking the voters for $500 million in new taxes. Dr. Fruits, congratulations. We'll put up the link to the piece that you wrote that details all the things they did. And I so much appreciate you coming on short notice to talk about this. Glad you could join me on a Wednesday. Tomorrow, I'll be broadcasting live from Bellingham, Washington, with our affiliate KGMI, and then a public event that night. When a virus threatens lives, should we put political correctness ahead of saving lives? And China is bad-mouthing the United States for protecting this country against the coronavirus. I'll talk about it next. Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and emails. We have been bringing you up to date on the status of the coronavirus. It now has a formal name, which they decided had to be politically correct, so it doesn't sound like anything. COVID-19, because they didn't want to call it the woo flu or the coronavirus. That made everybody think about beer. And they said we can't name it after anything that's a person, a place, a thing, a region, a group of people, or anything else, even though so many diseases in the world are known by their names, like Ebola, which is for a region in Africa, or Lyme disease, which is named for a town in Connecticut, or Lou Gehrig's disease. But in any case, today the latest development is this. There are more than 45,000 people who are sick, and most of them in China, more than 1,000 people who have died. And the disease doesn't appear to have peaked out in China yet, although if, as they tell us, the incubation period is 14 days, and you imagine people who got sick in mid-January would have it full on by the end of January, and by this point in February, the 12th of February, you'd think they'd either have recovered from the disease, and there are thousands of people, 4,000 or 5,000, who've recovered from it, but there are more than 1,000 who've died. It's a pretty stunning development. Well, now, our friend Dr. Betsy McCoy, who's very knowledgeable about public health, said she wrote this: Chinese government officials and the World Health Organization are bad-mouthing the Trump administration for trying to stop the coronavirus from invading the United States. Team Trump has barred foreigners who've been in China recently from entering our country. I thought that was sensible. Americans returning from China are quarantined for 14 days. China accuses President Trump of arousing fear. Yeah, I think. WHO, that's the World Health Organization, claims the president's policies, quote, unnecessarily interfere with trade and travel. And she writes, don't fall for this bombast. You can't fight an epidemic with political correctness. Mr. Trump's travel restrictions are saving lives here and sparing American hospitals, which are already overwhelmed by the flu season, from being thrown into crisis. Instead of bashing America, she writes, WHO officials should be criticizing Beijing's abusive methods of disease containment. Now, you've heard about the quarantines in cities like Wuhan and Hubei province and all that. Listen to this. Chinese officials are offering cash or free face masks to anyone who squeals on sick neighbors. Suspected virus carriers are dragged from their homes and trucked to quarantine warehouses where medical care is lacking, but contracting the virus is almost guaranteed. Now, I couldn't imagine this happening in America, but maybe we should imagine this. Imagine the day comes where they show up at your house and they have one of these temporal scanner thermometers and they say, you're showing a fever. We think you might have coronavirus. So they drag you off to a facility, probably better than the Chinese facility, and they throw you into a facility with a bunch of people who are sick with coronavirus. As she said, virtually guarantees that you're going to get it if you don't have it already. And as I said, this one is a killer. More than 1,000 people dead. So it has now killed more than many of the sort of famous viruses dating all the way back to the 1960s that have hit worldwide. You know, swine flu, bird flu, H1N1, all the rest of those. So I think she's right. And I think that this country has done everything that's sensible to say we don't want it in our country and we're going to make sure it doesn't get in. China, you take care of your problem. And we have offered to help them. In fact, as early as January 6th, the U.S. government offered help to China. You know what the Chinese said? We don't want your help. They probably don't want us to see how they're treating their own citizens. Let's go to Matt. Hey, Matt, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. And what's on your mind today?
I just want to point out that if they're looking at giving Roger Stone 7 to 9 years, there's a 40-year-old plus guy who is soliciting sex.
67. 67-year-old man.
67. Okay. Yep. No, I'm saying this other guy I'm going to give you an example of is 40-plus years old.
Right.
He was soliciting sex from 3 10-year-olds from a local elementary school here about 4 miles from my front door. And they gave this guy 16 months because they said he had no priors.
Wouldn't you want to throw people like that into a good long prison sentence, not just to get justice for his victims in whatever way we can, but also to send a message to anybody else who's ever tempted to do that kind of thing?
They said he was a friend of the family. So I don't know what that means. They weren't specific, but this guy should never see the light of day. To me, it just is an example of our priorities in this country. If someone who commits some sort of, you know, lying to the FBI, whatever they said Roger Stone did, versus someone soliciting Section 310-year-olds, this guy should never see the light of day. I just don't know where we're at in this country where that guy gets 16 months.
I agree with you. And let me you know what the most frightening prospect is of what you mentioned where you said you didn't know what they meant by is a friend of the family? I know that people, you know, the quintessential thing to be fearful of is your child in a park and some strange guy walks up in a raincoat and he's naked underneath or he's a flasher or whatever. That is not the most likely source of an attack, an assault, a sexual assault on your child. Unfortunately, the most likely assault, and I know this from the crime statistics, is from a member of your family. You might remember Oregon used to have a congressman by the name of David Wu, who was pretty strange. He was accused of rape in college. I think it was down at Stanford. But even after he'd been pushed out of office because of his strange antics, he was invited to Thanksgiving dinner at a friend's house. And he was accused of trying to sexually assault the teenage daughter of the family where he'd been invited to Thanksgiving dinner. Hate to say it, Matt, but really that is the most likely source of that kind of crime is people within your own family. It's why so often you'll see us.
What shocks me is though, yeah, because this guy's 40 years old. They said he had no 40 plus years old. They said he had no priors.
Well, the fact is that's probably because he's been getting away with it for a good long time. Matt, I've got a break. Thank you very much for the call. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
Exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
You're a lime dog-faced pony soldier.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest, covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho.
There was nothing I saw at night that would be able to take Donald Trump out.
Honestly, provocative talk.
That is the normalization of lawlessness.
Your voice is beautiful. I've heard it for a long time.
On FM News 101 KXL.
I shredded his state of his mind address.
And now, here's your host.
The credulous boomer rube demo that backs Donald Trump.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You would think that this would be relatively easy when the people in a given state, and by the way, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, but when the people in a given state say, the government is charging us far too much money for anything. And then they go out and they take on the absolutely gargantuan task of getting enough signatures and putting an initiative on the ballot, something that can cost well over $1 million, even if you use a lot of volunteers, that you would think when the voters say, we don't want that to happen anymore, we're going to change the law. Because in Oregon and Washington and Idaho, the constitutions of those states allow the public to both refer things to a vote or put things on for either to create a law or to get rid of a law. And you'd think that'd be fairly straightforward. The problem is that lately in Oregon and Washington, not so much in Idaho, you have efforts by those in government who do not want to take their marching orders from these foolish citizens out here. I mean, after all, what does an average citizen know? What does a voter know? Taxpayer, we're the elites. We make the decisions for you. They immediately will take any set of directions from the public, a vote in an initiative, and say, what's the best way to destroy that thing? And one of their first tools, of course, is to go to the courts and say, we're going to take this thing apart in the courts. And that's what they had hoped to do with the $30 car tab initiative that Tim Iman successfully put before voters and that the voters of Washington State, including me, voted to say, yes, I want $30 car tabs. And the powers that be, the folks in government who get the money that was being paid by the higher car tab fees, say, no, we're not going to let it happen. We're going to take it to court and try to upend the decision made by voters. Well, Tim Iman joins me now because he's actually scored a fairly significant victory today. Tim, welcome back to the program. And tell me what the court said about the latest effort to overturn the vote of the people.
People are going to be stunned that it's actually constitutional to put limits on government's power.
Imagine that.
No one thought it possible. No one thought it possible that we could actually get a Seattle judge that recognizes the fact that the voters are smart people. They know when they vote for a $30 tabs initiative, what the initiative did. And a couple of weeks ago, this judge said the voters might have been confused by this ballot measure. And frankly, a whole lot of people just beat the crap out of him for the last several weeks. And now he's reversed himself and said, you know, maybe they weren't confused by this measure, and I'm going to go ahead and dismiss all these various challenges by all these governments. So it's a stunning victory because no one ever thought it's possible. And let's be very clear, this is in spite of our attorney general trying to sabotage this thing, certainly not because of Bob Ferguson. We were able to win despite him.
Well, and it's funny because the other side of this, and it's the pro-government side, which tends to be more Democrat and liberal than it does a Republican and conservative. When you talk about shrinking government, at least the Republicans talk a good game. Real conservatives believe in the smallest government possible. And in fact, I'm in favor of the smallest government possible, that I would trim down state governments, city governments, county governments. But you would think that they would simply say, well, we understand that we serve the public and we serve because they have agreed to give us the authority to serve. I seem to remember something like that in both the Declaration and the Constitution at the federal level. I'm amazed that you got this because, Tim, I would have bet that a Seattle judge would have gone the other way. But did he go this way because he really, under the law, had no other choice, and it was going to probably go to a higher court, and he was going to be reversed if he had actually decided otherwise?
There's no doubt the guy had plenty of political cover in order to be able to strike it down. I mean, it's just what they do all the time. But it is a really insulting thing to say the voters didn't understand an initiative that's been on the ballot three different times that ended up having this huge, massive $5 million campaign telling everyone to vote no. 11 months, they beat the crap out of me. They beat the crap out of the idea. They said vote no on Tim Eyman's $30 tabs initiative. The initiative passes. Seattle sues the voters because they don't like the outcome of the election. And a judge says, you didn't understand what this initiative is all about. It was way too complicated, too confusing for you. And I think he reversed himself because it was just an absurd proposition that the voters didn't know what they were voting on. It's just silly.
So, Tim, at this point, we can all kick back and just celebrate because this will be the end of the efforts to destroy $30 car tabs, right? 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 Isn't that the way it works?
We always seem to think that an election actually resolves things. But no, when it comes to the opposition, a little thing like the voters wanting it is kind of the beginning of the fight. But it is a huge victory. I mean, to have a Seattle judge say that the voters weren't confused, that this initiative is all about $30 tabs, it doesn't have multiple subjects, the ballot title didn't mislead anybody. Everybody knew exactly what they were voting on. All the various claims by the government about this initiative was all rejected by this judge. It's a big, big deal.
So what happens next? Where are they going to go next so we can warn people how they're going to try to undercut this decision by the citizen? I mean, look, your name is so inextricably linked to a ballot initiatives because you've been doing it for a long time. But I don't want, no disrespect to you, but I don't think it is a Tim Eyman initiative. It is when it started. But when it goes to the voters, I think of this as the voters telling the government a set of orders, a set of, you know, directions to their so-called representatives. That, you know, even if I disagree with it, I disagreed with marijuana initiatives. I've disagreed with, doctor-assisted suicide. But I accept that the public, the voters specifically, have the right to make this decision, and it ought to be respected. Where are they going to go next?
Well, there's no doubt it's a knockdown, drag-out fight because we have a governor in the state of Washington, Jay Inslee, who refuses to implement this initiative. He's standing in the way of all of us getting the $30 tabs that we voted on. And so it's just a knockdown, drag out fight. It's the whole reason that I announced my run for governor, and I'm making a big announcement about that in my hometown of Yakima. And if people want to watch that tonight, it's going to be live stream on Facebook Live. Forgive me, it's tim4gov.com, Tim, the number 4, gov.com. And so we're fighting in the courts, but we're also fighting to get rid of Inslee, and let's have somebody that's actually going to listen to people rather than trying to rule over.
You might even get support from the state of Oregon because Oregon's been trying the same thing. We literally had a state senator named Jenny Burdick who on the carbon tax they're trying to shove through said she was asked by a reporter, why aren't you putting this to a vote? And she said, it's this carbon tax is just way too complicated for ordinary citizens, non-elites. Now, she didn't say it that way, but that's the way, are the words that popped into my head. She said it's too complicated for the voters. It cannot be decided. Now, I want to ask you one thing, and maybe a suggestion for how to get it done. If this is the direction of the court, as I understand, there's a thing in in the law in courts called mandamus. And as I understand a mandamus, it's when you go to the court and you say, the law is clear on its face. The sheriff is directed to do X. Judge, will you order the sheriff to do X? Any way to get a mandamus from a judge who probably won't like doing it either, but he may have to under the law, say, Governor Inslee, I am directing you to do what this law requires. Any way to do that?
There's no doubt that that is exactly the kind of thing that Attorney Stephen Pidgeon really deserves a tremendous amount of credit and an extraordinarily good job intervening in the case and defending the initiative. And he's right now doing what's called a motion for reconsideration to try and clean up some of the little ancillary issues that are involved with this thing. But
that is Tim Eyman. He's announcing his run for governor tonight, and you've got the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the Lars Larson Show on FM News 101. It's government gone wild.
Oh, hell no.
Now exposed every day on the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And about government gone wild, I told you earlier today, got a note from a gentleman who said, I have a piece of land. My house sits on the piece of land. It's big enough that I can split off a piece of that land and I can build a second house. And then my family will move into that and I will rent the other house. He said, but when he went down to get all the permits and such, they told him $60,000 to $70,000 in government permits, pieces of paper, before you can put a single shovel into the dirt or hammer a single nail into a single board. Well, here's another example of this. And these are things you can't really control. I mean, energy is at market price. Wood to build your house is at market price. Labor is at market price. Government is the one thing you could change where you say, does it make sense to require $60,000 to $70,000 or more simply for permission from your government masters for you to build a house on your own property? I think the answer to that one is easy. And it's the one thing that could be changed in the Northwest where we constantly hear government officials moaning and groaning, oh, there's not enough affordable housing. We don't know what we can do. I'll tell you what, take some of these ridiculous fees and charges that were never this way before and say, we're not going to charge you 70 grand to build a house in permits alone. Well, consider this because, you know, on Monday, the Seattle City Council unanimously passed over the objections of even a liberal like Mayor Jenny Durkan. They passed a ban on evictions. Now, originally, they had proposed that you could not evict somebody in the winter, and the winter was defined as November 1 to April 1. They tightened that up a little bit, made it December 1 through March 1st. So 3 months. A tenant could sit in your rental property and not pay you a dime, and you cannot evict them. Well, I got this email from loyal Lars listener Thomas Bickman. He says, Lars, the staggering laws being passed against landlords like me that make it more and more difficult to evict tenants, bad tenants, which in turn is driving up the cost of rental properties, which leads to lawmakers crying about affordable housing. You've talked about affordable housing, but not with an actual landlord who can give you a better insight into the real problems and why rents are being raised significantly by landlords, even in smaller cities like mine, Spokane, Washington. And my family and I own a good deal of properties, and for years we never raised rents. But with the increasing laws that tie our hands to evict bad tenants and allow tenants to tie up the eviction process for months, and by the way, I'll step aside from Thomas Bickman's letter to say, I have been a landlord in the past, I am not currently, and I have been to what they call FED court, where forced eviction declaration, where you have to go to a court and say, I need an order to force somebody out who is refusing to pay the rent. And by the time you get to FED court, it may be a couple of months down the line. And that means that you have lost the rent forever from those 2 or 3 months. And in all likelihood, if they're not paying the rent, they may not be taking the best care of the property either. He says, but we're tying up this process. He says landlords, in turn, are pushing to raise rents above their ability to afford in hopes of keeping out bad elements. And yes, bad tenants are directly connected to low-income areas. Also not commonly known is that a tenant is causing issues for the neighbor, the one next door, like the recent tenant I had to fight to evict who was running a heroin ring out of an apartment within only 2 months of moving in. The landlord can and will get fined by the city via the cop shop in charge of that neighborhood for allowing that to happen. However, lastly, this idiot law that lawmakers who think they are helping are in fact creating a much bigger problem. Are there slumlords who don't care and facilitate stuff like this? Yes. But there are people like me and my family, this is Thomas Bickman in Spokane, who buy these places. We spend tens of thousands to fix and repair and make them nice apartments that you can be happy and proud to live in, even as a low-income person. But with laws that work so greatly against landlords, what incentive do we have to risk allowing anyone low-income, who is more likely to be a real threat to us and our property and other tenants, a place they can afford? And he makes a very good point, that if you allow people to come into your property, and then you know, if it gets to December the 1st, they can simply say, hey, buddy, I'm not paying the rent, and I'm not going to pay the rent for the next 3 months, and you're going to be out thousands of dollars, and there's nothing you can do about it, at least in the city of Seattle, because the city council of Seattle says so. Let's go to Dave. Hey, Dave, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. You know that the Oregon legislature in its short session is bound and determined to try to ram through this $700 million carbon tax. What's your take on that?
It's all a lie, but what I wanted to just mention real quick is the congressman or legislator that you had on that said we're already carbon negative is 100% true.
Yep.
I sent this to you a year ago, I think, but I calculated with our forests, we have 66 million tons of CO2 consumption through photosynthesis a year.
Right.
And 2018, the last time that I saw the government put on any of this data, we had a little under 64 million tons of CO2 production.
By human activities, yeah.
Yes, by human activity. And then I'm not sure if you know, but yesterday the total worldwide CO2 emissions data was reported, but the media didn't pick it up because actually the emissions from 2019 dropped by 2.9% for the first time in 70 years.
And I would guess that most of that drop was because of what the United States did by using more natural gas for various things, by more efficient cars and all that, because you know that in China right now, they're building one or two coal-fired electric plants a week. One or two a week. And so
our government officials are trying to
tell us that we need to cut our carbon consumption and wreck our economy and raise taxes to offset what the Chinese are doing. Well, I disagree.
Well, so do I. But, you know, even it's clearly not caused by CO2 emissions, the raise in CO2, because, for example, I just said we dropped 2.9% in the last year, but Monday, Mauna Loa CO2 hit a new record of 416 parts per million. So as these two variables get further and further apart, their correlation goes just lower and lower and lower.
I agree with you, although I'll warn you that I always look for strong arguments, and I encourage people not to use the weaker ones, because the automatic response from the people who believe in man caused global warming, and they say man has to cut down on his carbon dioxide output of our industries and vehicles and everything else, they will say, yes, there's nothing we can do about volcanoes. They will tell you there's nothing they can do about forest fires, but that is a lie. There are things we can do to manage the forest so they don't catch fire as frequently and the fires are put out quicker. But they'll say we can't do anything about volcanoes, and they're right. So the natural caused CO2 outputs like that are things you can't legislate away. So they will say all the more. In some ways, they could turn your argument on its head and say because we can't control volcanoes and other natural production of CO2, all the more reason that human beings need to cut back dramatically. So I would urge you to go away from that kind of argument because it's a weaker argument because they immediately have an answer for it. But if you say America as a country has cut its CO2 output more dramatically than any other Western industrialized country. And as the poor countries, China used to be a very poor country, they now have a middle class that is bigger than our entire population. They have 400 million people in the middle class, and all of them want cars and refrigerators and television sets and everything else, and it's all going to produce CO2, and they're building lots and lots of coal plants. Thanks for the call, Dave.
Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your calls. The reason I have put so much focus on this carbon tax plan in Salem is because I know that the lawmakers in Olympia are trying to do the same thing to the state of Washington. Jay Inslee has tried to do it. They're all pushing for massive taxes on carbon, and not a bit of their plans purports to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide going into the air. And that's before you get to the familiar argument, not an argument, actually Chuck Weiss and I agree on it. He's the meteorologist, I'm not. But carbon dioxide is not the driver of global warming. Carbon dioxide is the evidence of global warming that may be happening, if there's warming at all, is happening, and it's causing greater CO2. And they've even got fossil records that go back hundreds of thousands of years that show when the Earth gets warmer, there's more CO2. Why? There's more plant growth. And do you know what plants do when they grow? Well, they either become your food or they die and they rot and they produce methane, and that goes back into the air. You get more CO2 in a warmer Earth. You get less CO2 in a cooler Earth. And we do have warming on this planet that happens because of natural forces. And we also have had cooling that happens because of natural forces. And Chuck Weiss knows that better than most. Chuck, you've been following what's going on in Salem at the state legislature. They're bound and determined to ram through this $700 million carbon tax before the end of the month, aren't they?
They certainly are. The latest I've heard on it, Lars, was that Senator Dembro is now talking about exempting certain counties, particularly the ones that represent timber unity, from having this tax take effect even beyond 2025. Exactly what he means by that, I don't know, because they haven't actually put anything in writing. But that's just the latest bone he's throwing out there to try to convince everybody to vote for this thing and get it passed. But that is a ridiculous, stupid way to go about trying to pass something, because how does he expect that people in those counties who might be exempted, whether it's permanent or temporary, are not going to end up getting the cost eventually passed on to them by having to do business in other counties that are going to have to pay this? That cost is going to get funneled through to everybody. So this is just a red herring being sold to people that, hey, you won't have to pay it, but we'll just make somebody else pay it. That's how frivolous this is.
And think how convoluted it would have to be. Take, for example, diesel. Diesel is the lifeblood of most long-haul transportation. It's also the lifeblood of farming, and it's the lifeblood of a construction industry. So this means that if you buy your fuel inside of a metro area, and the metro areas would be pretty larger in any of the counties where it applies, you'll be paying the tax. But you may be doing business outside the metro area. I don't think you could come up with a scheme complicated enough to somehow exempt the guy or gal who's running a construction company in Tillamook, but he's buying his fuel in Portland. I mean, how would they even do that? And then when it comes to electricity, you mean we're going to have different electricity taxes for every place, whether you're a city or a rural area? And the same thing for natural gas, the same thing for propane, the same thing for gasoline. And God help the trucker who's told, well, if you gas up in the, you know, rural parts of Eastern Oregon or Southern Oregon, you won't pay the tax. But if you have to diesel up when you hit Eugene or Salem or Portland, you're going to pay the tax. I mean, none of this makes any sense.
No, it doesn't make sense, because it won't work. Everybody's going to have to pay for this, and singling out counties is just ridiculous. It's just a red herring being thrown out to try to get the timber unity people to buy into this. And like I said before, Lars, the whole bill is a fraud, and the reason why I call it that is because they lie to you and they tell you it's about the climate. You could wipe out all of Oregon's emissions, which is physically impossible, and you would not be able to budge the atmospheric CO2 levels. So the entire thing is a fraud. If they're going to do this at all, they need to stop calling it a climate bill, call it what it is, which is an expensive energy sales tax, and put it out to a vote to the people. That's the only honest way you could go about doing this. But they don't want to face any of this, and to say that it's going to have an effect on the climate is just disputing what we know to be scientific fact.
I'm going to add something. My argument from the beginning, Chuck, is I keep hearing reporters call this carbon cap and trade, or carbon cap and invest, or the greenhouse gas bill. Well, and I tell them, what greenhouse gases does it control? And they say, well, you know, carbon dioxide. I say, how does it do that? Well, I don't know. And they don't. A lot of the reporters who've been covering this are just clueless. And you say, Well, okay, tell me how any of this would control carbon. Do you think it's worth asking Jenny Burdick or Michael Dembro or Kate Brown, how would this reduce the amount of carbon dioxide? And they don't have an answer, but it would generate $700 million that comes out of the pockets of consumers and industry. And it will probably tip over some industries. We've already seen NORPAC, the farmers cooperative, go out of business, big food processor. And why? Because their costs got too high. Salem and Olympia, and probably to some extent Boise, have all been as state capitals saying, you have to pay minimum wages of $15. You have to pay additional costs. We've got family medical leave. We've got guaranteed paid time off. So you add all these costs to a business. Then you jack up their electric costs, their natural gas costs, their trucking costs. And then you say, now try to stay in business. And the answer is some of them are simply going to fold up and go away. All of those different factors. You can only load so much on those businesses before they just collapse.
That's right. And so if you can't budge the CO2 meter by eliminating all of Oregon's CO2 emissions per year, if you can't budge the meter, the whole thing is a fraud. It's pointless to do it, and everything that they've calculated is based upon fictitious, non-physical numbers. That's the bottom line.
Well, and Chuck, here's the other thing, and it'll sound a little, not jingoistic, but here's the comparison I'd make. China is building one or two coal-fired electric plants per week in that country, 100 a year. America is building no coal-fired power plants, and we are, in fact, as a region, already forecast to head toward blackouts. This year, the number goes up dramatically, the percentage chance of blackouts. By the end of 2030, just 9 years from now, we're going to have a 30% chance of blackouts in the region. Now, and this is simply because there won't be enough electricity on certain days. Cold days in the winter, warm days in the summer, years when we have low stream flow for hydroelectric generation. And you wonder, how could we get to that position? Well, they've planned us into it. 12 major coal plants in the western United States are scheduled to shut down, including Boardman, including Centralia. They're planning our way into this. So China's building coal plants to supply the needs of its citizens. America is literally going to put the Pacific. If you felt sorry for all those people in California who are blacked out because they shut off the power lines to avoid fires caused by them during high winds, and you say, gosh, it must have been terrible to be one of those several million people with no electricity for days and days and days in California, get ready. Because Carbon Kate and her pals are planning to put you in exactly the same position, again, in name of and you say, well, what about the Chinese? They're using coal. Well, it's okay for them to do it. They are telling us we have to cut the tiny amount of carbon dioxide we put out so that the burgeoning economies of China and India can do it. And you say, it would be like walking up to somebody in a neighborhood and saying, you have to pay more taxes. And if you ask, well, does my neighbor have to pay more tax? No, we're going to exempt him. He doesn't have to pay the taxes, you do. You tell me how the average citizen would respond if he's told, or if you're in a town, you know, you're in Kirkland, Washington, and you say Kirkland has to pay higher taxes. Well, what about the neighboring communities? Nope, they don't have to pay. And then Dembro's trying the same thing as you pointed out. We'll exempt certain counties so we can get past them in the vote. And once we get it on the books, we'll rope them in a little bit later. You know that's what they plan to do.
That's exactly what they're going to do. And even if they don't do that immediately, like you've already pointed out, these costs will get passed on. There's no way you can draw a border and say that electricity and natural gas that goes through that border is going to be sold any cheaper to them when everybody else has got to pay the higher cost.
You know what? The farmer who hauls hay into the port of Tacoma or the port of Portland and says, I need to ship my hay off to China, to the buyers in China or in Japan, and is told, well, you got to diesel up your truck. Well, then I have to pay the tax. Yes, you do. And what about the fuel that's going into those ships that carries it? Well, they have to pay it too. And what about my fertilizer that gets shipped into the region on trucks and is made of petrochemicals? Well, that's going to be taxed as well. It's all going to go up, and you're going to pay it whether you live in the boonies or in the cities. Chuck, thanks very much. Back in just a moment. Glad to be with you. We'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back. to the Lars Larson Show. I have to tell you something. There's a guy I follow all the time, Charlie Kirk. And on Twitter, he says, so the Democrat field of presidential candidates started out with 28 diverse candidates. And diverse is in quote marks because you know what the left means about diverse. Well, now they're down to just 8 from that diverse field. And you know, the Democrats are all about diversity. It's diversity this, it's diversity that. I mean, you'd swear if they actually lived their lives this way, it would be the most bizarre thing. Like saying, well, when I go to the grocery store, I have to make sure that the checker who checks out my groceries is diverse. And if I have employees, it has to be diverse. Guess what the diverse Democrat Party is down to? 8 candidates at this point. We had 3 of them drop out this week. 7 are white people. 5 are men. 4 are millionaires. 2 are billionaires. And 4 of them are septuagenarians, which is a fancy way of saying they're above the age of 70. This is who the Democrats have chosen to represent the party of youth, income equality, and diversity. 2 billionaires, 4 people over 70, 4 millionaires, 5 men, and 7 white people out of a field of 8. And that's the diverse field of the Democrat Party. Let's go to John, who's listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, John, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Man, you couldn't have given me a better lead-in right there.
Really? And that was a guess. It was just a guess.
I was calling in because earlier you were talking about the coronavirus, Wuhan, and they're pulling people out of their house if they're suspected of having this virus.
They say that they're rewarding people who narc on their neighbors. You say, my neighbor, he looks like he's running a fever. Oh, here's a free mask for you, or here's some money. And then they go over and haul your neighbor off to a warehouse full of people, some of whom are sick. And if he didn't have coronavirus before, he gets it at the warehouse.
Right. And now everybody gets to go on social media and watch the videos for themselves of what's happening in China, while Bernie Sanders and all the rest of the Democrat presidential candidates are calling for socialized health care. That is what we're going to get. And we should be pushing that hard. Trump should be pushing that hard. Because if people really don't believe that's what socialized medicine is about, that's what China is, a communist socialist country. And that's what they're doing to the people that they, quote unquote, care about.
Yeah, I got to tell you something, John. Can I tell you that the only time I've ever heard something good, and it wasn't meant to convey that it was good, but where you hear something, you say, well, actually, that would be a good thing for America. I don't want socialized medicine. But about a year or two ago, I heard a series of reports. It was actually on, I think it was on NPR, but you know, I'm paying for it with my taxes. I might as well sample it from time to time. And they're always reliably left-wing. But they were talking about how in China, healthcare is free. Do you know how good something that's free usually is? If somebody says, oh, I got a free this or a free that. Usually free is worth exactly what you paid for it. Well, what they said was, because healthcare is free in China, but they would describe somebody who had to come in from a rural area into a city to a clinic, and then they could literally wait 2 or 3 days to see a doctor, right? And that's crazy. Mm-hmm. And they said, so this is the only positive that I could possibly see to nationalized healthcare or socialized medicine like that, is they said, in China, there's a huge movement of people who work their tails off to try to keep themselves healthy. They exercise, they eat right, they do all this, because in real terms, they can't afford to get sick. Now, you and I, John, might say, well, I can't afford to get sick. But you mean that because if you needed to, you could walk into an urgent care, and usually within 20 minutes, you'll see a doctor. That doesn't happen in China, and it doesn't happen in a socialized manner. Now, if you get brought in from a car wreck, they're going to work on you right away. You walk in and say, yeah, I've got the flu. Okay, take a number and sit over there. We might get to you. And in China, they might get you in 2 or 3 days. So all of these people, you know, they exercise, they eat right, and all this, because people are scared to death of getting sick. So if I had to make, it's kind of counterintuitive, but if I had to make an argument in favor of socialized medicine, which I don't believe in, I'd say, well, in a socialized medicine system, everybody in America who's fat or doesn't exercise or doesn't eat right or uses too much booze or drugs or whatever, basically you're giving yourself a death sentence, because if you get sick in America, you get taken care of. In a socialized medicine system, a lot of you are going to die waiting for care.
Well, I appreciate you taking my call, Lars.
Hey, it's absolutely my pleasure. And John, good luck to you, because this is the craziness that we are up against with Bernie Sanders suggesting Medicare for all. Has anybody looked? Have you even considered what the price tag is? It's north of $30 trillion over 10 years. And you say, well, that's $3 trillion a year. How does that compare to the federal budget? It is 75% of the current federal budget. So what would they have to have Medicare for all? Well, they'd have to increase the federal government's budget by 75%. Where do you think the money's going to come from? One of two places. Either they're going to raise your taxes dramatically because they can't do any other ways, or they'll borrow the money. Well, we're already $23 trillion in debt. Now, that's just the direct debt, where the government has borrowed money. If you count all of the obligations of the government, and I consider an obligation a debt, even though it's not like the formal federal debt. If the federal government has promised everybody Social Security, well, how much is that? About $40 trillion. Where's the money coming from? You taxpayers. Do we have it? No, we don't. Those are the short answers to that complicated question. Well, what about Medicare? Is that paid for? Nope, not by any stretch of the imagination. The money is not there to pay it. Well, then what's going to happen? Well, one of two things. Either they're going to tax the bejesus out of the United States of America, or they're going to tell a whole bunch of elderly people, you aren't going to get medical care. But they'll probably do it the Chinese way. Ma'am, you're 75 years old and you're sick. You'll see a doctor in a few days if you live that long.